over this manuscript with me for many, many years, and thank you for that. The nearest Walmart. The KOA campground in Amarillo, Texas, sits in a surprisingly seedy neighborhood, more urban than I had expected. A very middle-class couple with impossibly wide smiles advertises an adult video and novelty store from a billboard before the final turnoff to the campground. Cattle graze in a pasture along the road, an unsettling mixture of the bucolic and the pornographic. Rusted trucks sit in the driveways of rusted mobile homes. I'm here to visit Mott, a new and unlikely friend who wanders from place to place, dragging a coterie of dead relatives, celebrities, and Polish folktale villains, Old Testament gods, along with him. A month ago, he left our home, the home I share with my husband Scotty, stepdaughter Lucy, and another homeless man named Mike, in Morgantown, West Virginia, headed for Amarillo because cars, he said, can be had more cheaply out west, and he needed a car. But more than that, although he didn't say it, Mott had needed to move on. By his own report, he hasn't stayed in any one place longer than 3 months for more than 30 years. Friends have sometimes lasted a place or two, but never many. While they're around, his voices are quieter, more easily managed. Having someone real to talk with keeps him grounded, he says, and humor helps. Still, Mott's dubious about trying to stretch our friendship beyond his time in Morgantown. There are a lot of bad characters over here, he warned me on the phone, and most of them don't want you around. I'd planned to pitch my tent where he was camping. Because Mott had called it camping, I'd envisioned an uninhabited wilderness beyond the sprawl of Amarillo. I was wrong. During a rare phone call from a payphone at the public library, Mott told me he slept behind an abandoned industrial building on a busy thoroughfare. He had few belongings, extra clothes in a small backpack, an old digital camera I'd given him, a few tools, a wooden-handled knife from Dollar Tree. Each morning, he wrapped these things in a tattered black and red wool blanket he'd found in Romania. After hiding the bundle under a pile of rusted scrap metal near the building, he biked into town to spend the day at the library, at Walmart, or scouting around for a car to buy. In the evening, he retrieved the bundle, stashing the bike in its place. He slept on top of the old blanket, with a pillow made of his extra clothes. I'd scoured the web to find someplace more acceptable to stay during my visit. I was unwilling to stay in a hotel while Mott continued to sleep behind the abandoned building, and I was equally unwilling to pitch my tent there beside him. The small one-room cabins and large communal bathrooms of the KOA seemed a workable compromise. I'm comfortable with being bunkmates, but not roommates. Neither Mott nor my husband would mistake bunk beds and communal bathrooms as romantic. And my fascination with Mott is not romantic. It's a remnant of my disappointed desire to change the world and my stubborn belief that one person can do so. Mott says that having a friend, someone to talk to, helps, and the romance of being that person is what has me in its thrall. A few days before I left Morgantown for Amarillo, Mott bought a complete wreck of a car for $400 from a kid working at an ice cream store. He broke camp behind the abandoned building and began staying overnight in the parking lots of the four Amarillo Walmarts. He sent me an email with a picture of his ancient sedan, gray except for one bright blue door, with a bent frame that suggested a tragic past. I pulled into the KOA at noon, having promised to arrive by 4. I'm a little surprised Mott isn't here waiting for me. He and I share a social awkwardness. We are both early to everything. But I'm 4 hours early, so I'm not worried. I gather fresh clothes and wander over to the showers to wash away the road. I'm charmed listening to a young mother as she tries to wrangle her toddling son through the rigors of washing his hair. I've stumbled into an oasis of civility. I'd expected the campground to be full of half-drunk bikers and bedraggled women yelling at their children. I'm relieved to have been wrong, but I'm also concerned. Mott will most certainly stand out among these vacationing families and senior citizen sunbirds. I don't want anyone to hurt his feelings, and I begin to fear that these vacationing middle Americans might. Folks stop here and talk to one another, sharing vacation plans, asking about nearby attractions. I hadn't counted on that. I'm not sure how they will take his just to the left of things answers. The cabin is a medium-sized room with a double bed on one wall, bunk beds on the other, and three shelves. It'll be closer for the two of us than I'd imagined, but I'm won over by the porch, which is wide and sturdy and has a swing. It looks over a parking lot, some tent sites, and then a stockyard. It's not a lovely view. But the wind in Amarillo amazes me. It gusts with such strength that I spend a few minutes sitting on the swing, catching the breeze in my shawl and letting it pull me back, then releasing it and swinging forward again. The afternoon goes by slowly, viscous and sticky in the cabin, windswept and dusty on the porch. I'm not good at waiting. It invites worry, which I do too well. I call my husband Scotty several times to ask if there's been any word. There hasn't, and by the third call, he too is starting to sound a little ragged. Maybe you should just spend the night and then drive back, Scotty says. I can't tell if he's worried or annoyed. We've been married only a year, together for two, and are still learning to understand one another. I'm sure he'll show up. I'm just afraid something has happened to him. I checked my email, but nothing. How did you check your email? You left your computer here. On the phone. Oh, for God's sake, we don't have that service. That's going to cost a fortune. I stand on the porch of the cabin, letting that amazing wind tangle my hair as Scotty and I argue for a while longer. I agree not to use the phone to check email again, but I don't agree to come home. Even if Mott doesn't show up, it would be a lovely thing to spend a week alone in this little cabin. At 5:45, I can't sit in the cabin any longer, though. I ask the guy behind the counter for directions to the nearest Walmart, and he draws a very crude map on a napkin. I know it's a long shot. There are four Walmarts in Amarillo, and I'm not sure I can find even the closest one with the directions I've been given. I have no idea what time Mott usually settles in or if he's even still in town. I tell myself I'm not going to find him, and then I set out anyway. I see the old gray sedan with the tragic bent look as soon as I swing into the parking lot. I pull up several feet away and get out of my car cautiously. I can see the very top of a man's head, short gray hair spiked with grime in the driver's side window, but I can't be sure it's Mott. I'm afraid he may have abandoned the car or given it away, and I'm worried about what sort of person I might startle if he has. The man in the car is slumped over something I can't see. I slam my door, but the person doesn't move. I call Mott's name, a question in it, but I get no response. Left with no other choice, I walk over to the car, lean in the open window on the passenger side. There's Mott, pissing into an old soda bottle. He doesn't acknowledge me, and I pull my head out of the car and let him finish. He looks terrible, his hair wild and his face streaked with axle grease and mud. His clothes, a secondhand pair of khakis and an old mechanic shirt with their name Ernesto embroidered on it, are filthy, and the shirt is misbuttoned. He rarely looks his 66 years, but today he looks that and then some. Dirt exaggerates the lines around his mouth and eyes. A half pint of scotch sits open on the seat beside him. When he finishes, he puts the lid on the soda bottle, but doesn't zip his pants. He stares out the windshield, unmoving, and I can't tell if he isn't aware of me or if he's ignoring me. I walk around to the driver's side of the car and open the door. Mott turns his head toward me, looking more over my shoulder than at me, but he doesn't speak. "Hey, you," I prod quietly. "Aren't you even going to say hello?" He sits for a minute more before finally saying, "Nope. I mean, Sarah never showed up, so I figure that's that." "What do you mean I never showed up? I'm right here. I've been waiting for you at the campground since noon." I realize he doesn't think I'm real. I said I would be here on Monday by 4:00, and I was. You just never showed up at the camp. At the word Monday, Mott snaps his head around and looks at me, real anger animating his face. Yes, but you see, this is Tuesday. I went to the campground on Monday, and Sarah was not there. He spits the words at me and then cackles. He thinks he's just outsmarted whichever of his tormentors has conjured this hallucination of me into being. It's not Tuesday, I say firmly. It's Monday, and I'm here exactly like I said I would be. Out of the corner of my eye, I notice a police car swing into an empty space a few yards away, watching. Mott reaches past the bottle of urine and a coil of old aquarium tubing, fumbles through the garbage under the passenger seat, and pulls out a greasy newspaper. No, it's not. Today is Tuesday. See, I have today's paper right here. He smacks the front page with his paralyzed hand and then waves it in front of me, triumphant. I peer in, finding the date on the masthead. No, look, right here. It says it's Monday. I point. He looks. He looks again. Suddenly, his features seem to right themselves. He runs his hand through his hair, taming it, and then drops the paper onto his lap, hiding what he suddenly realizes is exposed. Oh, he says, as if seeing me for the first time. It's you. I move away from the car to give him time to gather himself. I turn my back for a few minutes, standing between the sedan and the gaze of the policeman. And then Mott is beside me, his arms outstretched. We hug. He pokes me a few times and sniffs the air near my ear as if to make certain I'm real. Well then, let's go to the KOA, he says merrily. The policeman talks into his radio, his eyes meeting mine as Mott and I finish our hellos, our hugs, our sheepish apologies. It would be best to get out of here before the cop notices the open bottle of scotch on Mott's seat. And so even though I'd meant to pick up something for our dinner, I agree. We pull up in front of cabin one. I got a shower, Mott says the minute we are parked. He gathers the things he needs from the trunk of his car. For half an hour, I wait on the porch swing, rocking back and forth, trying not to decide that I have to go home. Maybe Scotty was right. Maybe I should spend the night and then drive back to West Virginia. In the parking lot, I saw more of Mott's illness than I had known was there, and it scares me. I think about his warning. There are a lot of bad characters over here, and most of them don't want you around. The reasonable thing would be to offer him the use of the cabin for the time it's already rented, and then simply drive away. But although I can't articulate why I'm here, I'm sure it's not to insist that everything be reasonable. When he finally reappears, smiling broadly as if things have gone perfectly so far, my fear subsides. He looks younger again, his graying hair neat and growing out of the military cut he'd given himself with the old clippers we keep for trimming the dogs on the evening before he left Morgantown a month ago. His skin is wrinkled and tanned. Freshly washed and in clean clothes, he looks more like a retired gentleman with a passion for sailing than one who has been living out of doors, homeless for over 30 years. And although a close look will show that his left hand is curled into itself and that he drags his left leg a little bit, he doesn't look frail or old or crazy. He is, in fact, a little handsome. We talk about not being hungry and decide against wandering off in search of dinner. Instead, we swing. I tell him about the drive, and he reminisces about his own trips down old Route 66. He retrieves the remaining scotch from the front seat of his car, and I buy a six-pack of beer from the camp store. We sit outside for a long time, catching up. Night never seems to fall in Amarillo. Dusk stretches on well into what I would have expected to be darkness. A little into the beer, we start reciting poetry for one another. I pull up things memorized during childhood elocution lessons, mostly Emily Dickinson and a little Shakespeare. They're not the best of either. Mott's repertoire is more varied. There is Wordsworth, Coleridge, and the inevitable Kipling. We struggle together through Prufrock, meeting up only as the mermaids are singing each to each. Then Mott begins to recite from a slew of poets I don't know, men who wrote verse about sailing, cattle drives, and saloons. He finishes with Robert Service's The Shooting of Dan McGrew, a poem I'd scoff at, except it leaves him damp-eyed and melancholy. Once we've downed the scotch and most of the beer, I asked him what happened to make him lose a day. Asking about the goings-on in Mott's peculiar universe is always risky. Speaking about the big guys upstairs can sometimes summon them. I don't know, they can just do that. Drop me down into a dark hole so that I can't see or hear anything. And then when I wake up, I'm confused and I don't know what day it is or anything. His tone says that this should be obvious and that I've asked a silly question. I'm always a little startled by how matter-of-fact he is about his delusions, how he forgets that I don't have a direct line into what's going on. Who dropped you into the hole? It was probably Molech, but I don't know, could have been the girls. The harpies were all excited that you were on your way. They figure they can use you to finally turn me into a girl, because I like you, and we want to be like the people we find likable, right? He laughs. I mean, I don't want to be a girl, but there you have it. They think it's a done deal up here. He motions upward with his thumb. The Dital hand of delusion paints everything that happens to Mott on an epic scale. Over the months of our friendship, I've learned enough about the characters to follow his stories. Like reading the Brothers Karamazov, most of the trick is in keeping the names straight.
This will be a really amusing reading. This essay is called Selling, and it's set in Bali. It was a cremation, but forecast festive and slow getting going. The body was still inside Ubud Palace, and a period of milling around had set in. Folks in the street were getting restive, beginning to burn too in the Balinese sun. The crowd had begun to thicken around shady patches with a view. I was standing in one of the shady spots and not totally proof against the anxiety continual shifting under compression will produce. I had my stone face on. I'd been wearing it since the awful Australian couple had pushed in next to me a few minutes before. They shared that overcooked look certain oily types exhibit when they get old. Too much, too wrinkled tan, and too much of it showing for the occasion. Way too much. If they'd have shut up, I might have taken an interest in their grilled looks, but they whined. She did, anyway. His face was contracted into what must have been a habitual sneer, a mask. The woman whispered loudly that the guy next to her kept pushing her, and that guy would have been me. As if. I was faintly amused. But the couple directed their ire on me only in passing. Their focus was out there in the sun, had settled on the street hawkers. I'd been watching a bent man myself who was trying to sell conical hats, like Vietnamese field hats, but painted in the traditional Kamazan style of Bali. Good looking, and they would cast some shade, but the bent man was having no luck selling them and was looking dejected. He'd looked dejected when he arrived. I'd seen him come and marked at once the legible character of his face. The Australian couple was yammering hard in outraged commentary on a woman selling sarongs and sashes. Balinese caps to lightly clad tourists who might want to show a little respect. It registered late that the grilled Australians had shook her off gruffly just before they climbed the steps to where I was standing. The woman selling sarongs hadn't approached me, perhaps because I was already wearing what she was selling, a batik sarong, a proper sash, a funny little hat. Bob, she's asking 100,000. She was. A deprecating smile belying the seriousness of the number. A watcher, I felt chagrin not to have noticed the sarong seller's face before. Sarong sellers were thick on the cobbles of the block street in front of the palace, especially around the feet of the great black and gold sarcophagus, a kind of overgrown bull built just to house the dead man when he was given over to the fire. At first glance, The street hawkers all look the same, wares stacked high and balanced on their heads, arms and shoulders draped with batiks and cheap shimmering stuffs. Except that face. The sarong seller I had missed fell, if anywhere, a little below average in appearance. Her own sarong was rumpled, and she wore a dingy white t-shirt over it. A t-shirt of the worst sort, awful graphics and faded baby toy colors disfiguring it. Cheap rubber thongs, I think. Pink, I think. The nerve, she's shameless, Bob. She must have been 40s, I'm guessing, and 40s in the tropics shows a lot of weather. No makeup, whatever. But good carriage and clean, even teeth. A half hour later, the Australian's couple's censure had not flagged, nor my attention. The sarong seller had made several sales, always for the same price, as much as she could get, which varied wildly. And I think it was this more than anything that excited the biliousness of the Australians, who, in any case, had been crowded left by late arrivals. Every transaction ended amicably, I noticed, and that she'd enjoyed sales plural under the circumstances struck me as highly improbable. The goods were not so good, the competition heavy, and the tourist already hardened to being dunned in the street. She sold to people already appropriately dressed with her face. The face of the sarong seller showed in the pre-cremation crowd was the most expressive I'd ever seen, bar none. I know the bald statement must sound incredible, but it's true. Yes, I've seen anguished faces and faces whitened by mortal dread, faces lit by sudden joy, and nothing that registered in the sarong seller's face was anything near so intense. Oddly, I have no idea what, if anything, she was feeling. Hers was a made face, artful, and not at all about extreme feelings. No, her expressiveness shone as pure animation, like a breeze in the wintering leaves of a small beach. Before any look was fully formed, another had begun to replace it in the reaches of her face. Really, I'm only realizing it now, her expressions fell within quite a narrow range, all genial, encouraging, a very light, almost abstract flirtation. But even within so limited a range, the sarong seller never seemed to repeat a look. Perhaps she did, but my impression was that she had independent control over the most minute parts of her face, and therefore had a vast repertoire of faces to show, all affecting. The procession began. As if a dam had broken, quite suddenly, the bull sarcophagus swept by, bobbing on the flood. A young man tied to its back, holding on for dear life. Then the ceremonial stair in the nine-tiered tower on which the body and a few members of the family rode, one man holding aloft a stuffed bird of paradise in his free hand. The structures were enormous. The tower may be 60 feet high and fixed to heavy frames made of triple-layered giant bamboo. The authorities had taken down the wires across Jalan Raya so the procession could pass, blacking out power all over Ubud. The dead man was carried at a run. The Tutan Australians elbowed their way out into the crowd in the first wave and were swept away. I never saw them again. A few minutes later, I waded into the current myself and was borne far down the main street of town to Piradalam, the temple of the dead. I left the sarong seller's face behind, but even in the jostling and high-spirited race to the burning ground, I was thinking about it, seriously charmed. A few days before, I'd read a digression in Balinese Dance and Drama by Walter Spies and Beryl de Zute, which had casually explained the superior expressiveness of a particular Lagong dancer by noting simply that as a child she had been a degang, a seller, in the little carnival of treats that often springs up around a dance performance. Spies and de Zute, writing about Bali in the 30s, described the selling going on around the dance, the metagang, as a virtual school of deportment, of flirtation and seductive glances. Like everything else in Bali, if then more than now, metagang had been elaborated and refined to something like an art. I immediately recognized the sarong seller in Spies and De Zoute's description of metagang, sure as I was that what I had seen on her face could not have been strictly a personal quality, though she must have had extraordinary aptitude. I'd seen the sarong seller's face in fragments in many other Balinese, selling and not. In hers, I think now, I saw metagang whole. At a cremation in Bali, a watcher soon comes to understand there will be time to think, plenty of time. After the body is carried down the ceremonial ramp out of its 9-tiered tower and borne in circles around the sarcophagus and almost dropped to the delight of many, but maybe that was show, enclosed in the body of the looming bull, after the priest has chanted and blessed the body in the mounded offerings and the wood has been stacked and soaked in coconut oil, after the fire has been lit and the wife has made as if to join her husband on the pyre in sati and has been ritually restrained, after everything is flames but the head of the great bull and the guest and the hired help have gathered in the shade to eat, there is time to wonder, hours to consider and reconsider. Even for a traveler, self-consciousness doesn't press in to ruin things at a cremation in Bali. Tourists are welcomed, even their inanities. They enjoy the rare fortune of a role that doesn't involve spending money. The raucousness of the proceedings is meant to confuse the spirit of the dead man so it won't return to haunt the living. The know-nothing ways of tourists are welcomed then, as conducive to bedlam. Probably I funked my part, quiet as I am. I'd been watching and hadn't seen any sign of grief. Even the wife's gesture to Sati had shown clearly as pure theater. She looked tired, that's all. Those most closely bereaved looked occasionally serious, but never stricken, or even sad. I searched for loss in their faces and didn't find it, nor any sign of strain to suggest the faces they were wearing were put on. How you believe makes death different, it hardly needs saying. While the fire burned, still under the influence of the sarong seller's metagang, I found myself thinking again about faces, about mine in particular. Curiously enough, it's been one of the great facts of my life. Perhaps your face always is, so in an abstract way, I guess I'm talking about you too. As far back as I can remember, my face at rest has elicited the question, what's wrong? I was as sweet-tempered a male child as you can imagine, but even so, in grade school, I regularly bore the blame for my misbehaving friends in fractions. My best friend's mother asked that her son be placed in a different class. Another forbid me the house. Girls turned skittish under my dark gaze. Smile. I heard it all the time. Cheer up. Injunctions that did not help but made my face stiffen, and sell yourself, advice I always found singularly chilling. In short, I had no metagang, none at all, and no school to learn it in, no examples of faces rippling under the light breath of sheer animation, so attractive. Perhaps I would have wanted that. Those who sold themselves in the school of my youth struck me as frightening creatures. Faces not animated, but contorted into fixed wooden smiles. To that boy, it seemed a world of hideous grinning mask, or morons. A boy with a problem, obviously, and I knew it even then, but knowing it didn't solve it. I haven't solved it to this day, nor given up trying. Even in late middle age, I have retained a hopeful sense of becoming. Once the sarcophagus and all the funerary offerings had burned away, except the bull's surprisingly elegant neck and confident face, two men with stout poles began to prod the dead man's corpse, tearing the winding cloth in flaming layers, freeing the body to drop into four wire rings suspended from an inflammable frame. Even hanging over a roaring pyre, A body burns slowly. This man, emerging from his sheets, did not hurry. To help him along, the men working the cremation doused him in coconut oil, running it over him out of the hollow end of a wrist-thick length of bamboo, and the flames leapt up, licking and crackling. The crew labored intently. It was hot work, like men tending a great fire in an open hearth. I sat down on a stone in the flickering shade of an arching palm to wait, to remember, letting the past back in. Sometimes, often, I feel I'm attended by a ghostly double, another fellow, not me, standing just beside me or peering over my shoulder, a gloomy guy, a regular death's head. When I'm alone, I'm alone, but when I go out, meet someone, he's likely to turn up, as if he prefers company. The oddest thing is that though he's a ghost and a dummy, to other people, he's realer than me. He is me to them. At the cremation, the living were fading away. The burning grounds had thinned, the sun's fire enough to disperse casual observers. The dead man's dummy had charred but was still distinctly with us, taking his time. He had gotten beyond hurry and perhaps misunderstandings. The gap between who we are and what shows on our faces had radically closed for the dead man. There can be no gap when there is only flesh, and soon there would be no flesh either. Perhaps one of the attractions of the fleshly life is grounded in just this, the luxury of relaxation, of letting the tension go. And in this, perhaps, the life of the mind is not so very different. Forgetting the face relaxes us, too. Still, the big difficulty cannot be overcome. The face is flesh, thoughts, feelings, all the worlds of consciousness are not, obviously. Yet about this, I must have been confused growing up, thinking I should make manifest what was going on inside me. Integrity demanded it, I felt, but the whole project was futile. The face bears at best a metaphorical relation to consciousness, one thing standing for another, and out of the yawning gap between them rise up the specters, masks, puppets, the painted faces of mimes, the cosmetic arts, the faces of actors, conventional faces, the faces you prepare to meet the faces that you meet. Most of life is so much signage. Out in the sun, I noticed, the cremation crew was treating the corpse with surprising roughness. They had been exploring his chest cavity with a blackened cane poker, and now one of the workers stood in front of the suspended dead man, banging him hard in the forehead with an enormous, blunt bamboo pole. The force of each strike drove the dead man back and forth, swinging on the iron rings that kept him from falling into the fire. The break here. And so what if the face is all metaphor, so much signage? We read the signs, after all. It's one of the ways we try to know, one of the ways we try to be known or to deceive. Hadn't I been confident about the old Australian's fixed sneers, what the old Australian's fixed sneer said about his consciousness? Perhaps my problem had always been just that my signage was out of control. No doubt, I had created that mask, my face, not willfully, nor with any art. My difficulties were in part cultural, a mute protest against the strange migration of identity outside, onto the face, the body. Would it even be possible to go much further into that country? When I was born, the caravans had already been traveling a long time. About the sarong seller, I wondered why her face, the artful face of Metagang, should have so pleased me. Expressive, it didn't express what she was thinking or feeling. But to an extraordinary degree, it did show the difference between a live face and a dead one. It helps to have looked at the dead to know how living shows. It is in motion, yes, but not only. Like sunstruck water rippling over stones, it's not wholly transparent. The afternoon had cooled a little when I got up to leave, and things had quieted down. The dead man looked a little smaller. Odd to say, the space he was hanging in seemed not to be there. He had burnt down to an absolute blackness, dull as ashes. He seemed more of an absence in the flames than a presence there. Looked at in profile, he seemed to have no depth, none, like he'd been cut out of the blackened, out of a blackened tin sheet. But his absence had a shape. He'd been suspended chest to the ground, and in the fire his back had arched, his face come up as if he was looking ahead. An absence in the shape of an angel. Thank you. If you want to see the dead guy, it's page 100 in here. You can see that Ashy Angel. So thank you very much.
Thank you both. That was wonderful. We have books for sale, of course, and maybe some brownies left, or they look kind of gone, actually. But I hope you'll stay and talk with our writers and get them to sign your books and all of that. Thank you.